Support for Science Friday comes from Northeastern University, where researchers are creating innovative science, technology, and policy solutions to make coastal cities sustainable. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We all know that we evolved from a common ancestor of apes. My next guest says that if you really want to understand how and why the human body works the way it does and it looks the way it does, you need to go all the way back to fish, and even worms and jellyfish. You get answers to questions like why our inner ear is made up of three tiny bones, and why do we get hernias? Neil Shubin, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago and author of Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body. He also hosts the three-part PBS series called Your Inner Fish. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. You've been able to take some pretty big scientific ideas and explain them in a way that anyone can understand. How do you approach writing and explaining these ideas? People always say, do you have a target audience you're looking at?
Well, my target audience really is a highly literate, but perhaps not scientifically informed general public. I mean, the particular person I typically have in mind is my dad, who happens to be a writer who is intimidated by science. But you know what I try to do for each segment, whether it's a chapter or a segment in the show, is really think about the kinds of science I'd like the audience to know, and then to develop a narrative, a story that gets us there. And what I like to rely on is the power of scientific discovery as a storytelling device, that people venturing into the unknown and exploring and discovering has a human aspect to it, and I always like to return to that humanity behind discovery.
With the broadcast of your three-part series, Your Inner Fish, and with Cosmos and with the Big Bang Theory TV show, do you find there's sort of a new or rekindled interest in science among the public these days?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, I definitely feel it. And it happens in a couple ways. The first is not only the shows that are out there, but on the internet, we have a very informed you can follow up on any scientific discovery, anything you read in the newspaper. You can get great information on the web, the blogosphere, and so forth. So there really are the tools for people to explore science. And I think there really is an appetite for science, for discovery, for wonder, and so forth. Cosmos is certainly tapping into that, and I think Interfishes as well.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 1-844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, if you'd like, and like to talk about evolution, science, Neil Shubin, the inner fish in you. Let's talk about the inner fish in you. How is the human body connected to the fish body? Give us some idea.
Yeah, so I mean, it starts by the realization that if you look at the tree of life, inside every part of our body, every organ, every cell, every gene, we have one entire branch of the history of life, which is knowable. It's knowable by fossils, it's knowable by comparing DNA and so forth. But if you look, you look at your arms, and we trace them all the way back, through mammals, through reptiles, amphibians, all the way down to fish, they compare to the paired fins of fish, which we can connect from the fossil record, from developmental biology, multiple lines of evidence. Sometimes this takes us to really surprising places, which is great if you're trying to tell a story of science. If you trace our jaws and ear bones back, it's very clear that they relate to gill structures in fish. And again, we know that from multiple lines of evidence, both the fossils as well as the DNA and development. So many of the muscles and nerves and bones, that we're using to communicate right now, me talk and listen and so forth, are derived from gill bones and sharks and fish. And that seems so utterly strange. But then when we unpack that story, with the evidence behind it, it becomes very powerful.
One of the most interesting parts of the book there for me, and I liked all parts of it because I like this trivia about where we all came from, it has to do with the eyes and the ears and how they work together and how the inner ear works. It was quite fascinating.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts. I used to teach the human anatomy course here at the University of Chicago, and I teach it at the undergraduate level now. And you think about just the basic mechanism by which we turn our heads and know ourselves in space, yet the eye is coordinated to where we are in space. As you move your head, your eye can remain fixed in gaze. And that's happening because of a communication between your brain and the muscles in your eye. And it's wonderfully complex, but it's also wonderfully ancient. And we can trace, you know, the inner ear is indeed one of the most ancient parts of our body. The middle ear is a little less ancient, and the external ear, you know, the flap that we can wiggle, some of us, is the most recent shared with mammals.
Mm-hmm. You also say that hiccuping is linked to our connection to tadpoles. Not much of a stretch.
Yeah, well, there's a paper that appeared in the scientific literature in the journal Bioessays in 2003 that contained this hypothesis with a lot of data to support it. And basically what they said is that, you know, when you hiccup, is a sharp inspiration and then a closure of your glottis and your epiglottis. So that's what causes the hic. Well, that comes about through a complex but stereotyped pattern of activity of nerves and muscles of our, you know, of our pharynx and of the back of our throat and our chest and so forth. Mm-hmm. What drives that is in our central nervous system, a central pattern generator. It turns out that central pattern generator is also seen in other critters, and it's part of the normal breathing of tadpoles that have both lungs and gills, but use a version of a hiccup to push the water across their gills and not enter their lungs.
Mm-hmm. You have a very interesting explanation of what goes on inside our bodies when we drink alcohol too much. And what happens, you know, why, I never understood that. You write very well about why we get dizzy and drunk and have a, you know, hangover. Give us a brief description of what's going on there.
Well, so the alcohol affects much of our body, obviously, and part of it affects our inner ear. And what that does is, you know, where we, you know, our balance in space is controlled in part by fluids that sit within the inner ear. Well, alcohol can change the density in certain ways of those fluids. It changes a bunch of other things too, such that when those fluids move, we perceive movement. So when you move in space, those fluids will swish around a little bit in your head and you will perceive it as motion. But those fluids can be tricked to move by alcohol as it enters them and changes the density of the fluids inside, so that fluid can be tricked and you can be tricked thinking you're moving. So that would be the spins. And what happens in those cases, even before then, is you can get a very stereotypical flick of the eye called a nystagmus. And that comes about from, again, this connection between the inner ear and the eye. And that's actually in many states part of the alcohol test that's given by the side of the roads, that when you see a state trooper shining a light in somebody's eye, they're looking for this nystagmus, which comes about from the brain thinking you're moving when you're really not, and it's causing your eyes to flicker.
Mm-hmm. And you also say, you give a reason for what happens when you have a hangover. Your liver is doing something and your body's doing something else.
Well, the liver's really sort of metabolizing the alcohol, but of course there's so many byproducts of that alcohol that are now produced that are swirling through your body. But moreover, your inner ear is still recovering, so you can still suffer from those balance issues.
Do we take anything with us from sharks? They're very old. What parts of our body?
You name it. So obviously the cartilages that our body forms in are derived from sharks. But if you look at the complex tangle of nerves in our head, these are the so-called cranial nerves. If you look in a human head, they are amazingly complicated. There are 12 of them. They wrap around each other. They go to all our different tissues in our heads. It turns out if you really want to understand the basic architecture of our cranial nerves, indeed the structure of our brain, go to sharks. I found that very useful when I was teaching human anatomy.
Really?
Because it has these, these cranial nerves as well, but they're in a much simpler state. You can see it in a raw or pure, even indeed simpler state. Likewise, the way they exit the brain is much simpler too. So, you know, the basic wiring and the plumbing inside our heads, you can see it in a much simpler form in a shark.
What about the connection,
so thank you, sharks,
connection to hernias, though?
Yeah, the connection to hernias is one of my favorites. I happen to know it very well, unfortunately. So if you look at what happens during development in a shark or a fish, the gonads actually begin high up, actually close to the heart, above the kidneys. And then they sit there, right? Well, when we develop, what happens to our gonads? Well, our gonads, if you're male, they sit in the scrotum, which is a little sac. In females, they're lower too. They're near the uterus. So what happens in a human is we begin our development with the gonads in a fish position, but as we develop and grow, they descend. In females, they descend to the level of the uterus, but in males, they descend and actually push out of the body wall to form this little sac, the scrotum. Well, what this traveling of the gonads does is it creates a weird loop in the male plumbing, and that creates is involved with the development of a weakness in the male body wall, both during development and later in life. So the male propensity for certain kinds of hernias relates from starting your development like a fish and then ending your development like a mammal.
844-724-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Christina in Springfield, Virginia. Hi, Christina.
Yes, hi. This is Christina. This is a very fascinating program, and I have a question. I never actually grown wisdom teeth, and so I was wondering if that is a sign of evolution or whether it's just a freak of nature.
Oh, you're not a freak of nature. Don't ever describe yourself. We're all freaks of nature in a sense because we're all different, right? I mean, so variation is the stuff of life. So let's say that one first. But, you know, when you look at humans have a normal variation in the number of teeth that are produced, particularly in the back of the tooth row. I don't think there's necessarily a strict evolutionary signal to that. But what it is it's more of an outcome of how our bodies are built during development and, you know, the kinds of genetic changes that happen.
See, Christina, you've avoided all those problems people get with wisdom teeth. See that?
Yeah, I guess I'm the lucky one, right?
Absolutely. Have a good weekend. Thanks for calling.
And same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. What surprised you? I'm talking with Neil Shubin, author of The Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion-Year History of the Human Body. What surprised you or has surprised you the most about your research?
You know, in the research?
Yeah.
I guess I'm continually pinching myself in the power of paleontology, discovering new fossils to explain, you know, why creatures look the way they do. You know, I know that because I'm a paleontologist, but,
right,
you know, the new finds are happening, you know, every month you read about them and what they're revealing about the history of life. And I guess what really attracts me to the field, and I still find somewhat, you know, pleasantly surprising, is just that, you know, this is a knowable history, that these events that happened billions of years ago, we can produce evidence to show how they happen. And I guess I'm always pinching myself when that happens. And it's always like the first time when I see these things.
So you think we're still sitting on a lot of fossils yet to be discovered?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're launching a whole new set of expeditions this summer to a new time period. There are whole parts of the world that have yet to be really explored. We have new technologies that change how paleontologists work.
What do you mean by that?
One of them, real powerful ones, is CT scanning. That is, there's high-energy CT scanners that you can take a rock, right, and pop it in one of these scanners, and it'll show you if there are bones inside, and then it'll show you the reconstruction of those bones. And then you can take those bones and look at the fossil from the inside. Then if you really love it, you can take that file and print it out in a 3D printer and of different sizes, so you can start to analyze the fossils. So I think the revolution in both 3D printing as well as CT scanning is really changing the face of paleontology in a big way.
I'm Ira Flato speaking with Neil Shubin, author of Your Inner Fish, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, that's using stuff in a way I would have never thought about. A 3D printer and a CT scanner. Is it, you take it with you on out to the site, or do you have to dig up the rock and bring it to the lab, or?
Yeah, right now you have to bring the suspect rock back, right?
Right.
So, because these things are so heavy. We work in the Arctic, and it's, you know, helicopters and weight limits are really strict. So where it really helps paleontologists is, you know, these folks who work on early mammals, you know, some of these fossils can be really, really small. So what they do is they scan it, and then they can do a 3D printer. You know, they can blow it up in size so they can analyze it. So it's really revolutionized their work. But, you know, folks are going through collections, you know, all across the world as we speak, scanning rocks that are sitting in shelves unstudied in collections, you know, for whole new things.
Well, and then you scan it, you make a model of what's inside the rock without going into it?
You got it. Yeah,
wow.
It's totally non-destructive. Yeah, it's really fabulous.
That is fabulous. And do you remember your first days as a fossil hunter? What it was like?
Yeah, I didn't find anything. I was an awful fossil hunter. I was terrible.
Well, what does it take to be a good one?
I was an embarrassment. I think it takes a lot of persistence. I wanted to be good. And when I started, you know, we went to Arizona. This is like 1982. I was a first-year graduate student, and I was very unsure about this whole thing. And I went out with a team of crack fossil finders. These were the aces. These were the best. And, you know, we were looking for small fossils, and I'd be walking with them, and they'd be just picking up bags and bags of fossils. And I'd be sitting there looking at them with this blank look in my eyes. So eventually, and I'm trying to ask them, like, how do you do this stuff? What do you do? And they try to describe it, but I never got it. But then one day, you know, it just kicked in. I start to see the distinction of bone from rock. And and when it did, it was like I was wearing a whole new pair of glasses. You know, all of a sudden I saw, you know, fossils everywhere. And then it hit me, you know, and my brain was trained. And so I go through that experience all the time now when I go to new places, but I just kind of have faith that it'll kick in at some point.
You talk about finding fossils that are the size of a grain of dust. I mean, like a period on the page. How do you find that?
You know, crawl. So it's really a funny scene because, you know, here you are in this giant landscape in the middle of some exotic desert, whether it's in the Arctic or in North America, what have you, and all the paleontologists looking for these tiny things are on their hands and knees, you know, with their eyes about, you know, 3 inches from the ground.
Right.
You know, so there's no high technology there. That's just crawling paleontologists, I'm afraid.
And so where would you really like to go that you haven't gone yet? Looking for fossils.
Well, that's this summer. I'm really stoked about what we're doing. So we're going up to northern Ellesmere Island, which is a region just across from Greenland. We'll be a few hundred miles from the North Pole for an area of unexplored rock of about 500 to 400 million years old. This is the earliest window in fish evolution.
Wow.
Yeah, we're really, it's kind of like starting.
Yeah, where was that rock at the age that you're looking at? Where on the Earth did it move from?
Yeah, great. So that it was at the equator, more or less.
It was
about 10 degrees north. Yeah. So what you have captured in those rocks is a warm, watery world of sort of shallow, nearshore seas. And so that's the perfect environment to find some of these early vertebrates or early fish. And, you know, it's kind of like the Tiktaalik expeditions, which Ted Deschler and Farish Jenkins and I led up to southern Ellesmere Island to discover this link between water and land. We're starting again with the same toolkit and new time period. It's kind of the exciting part, you know. We're really doing some basic exploration.
And no expectations of what you're going to find. Just looking.
Yeah, just a lot of hope, but we're just looking, you know. So it's a multi-year slog. It's hard to work up there. You can only be there for a few weeks at a time.
Yeah. Well, Neil, we'll have you back when you find something.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Good luck with the TV show and good luck on your book. Neil Shubin is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago, and author of Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body. It is so well written. It is so easy to understand. I highly recommend it to all of you. You can also watch his three-part series, Your Inner Fish, now on PBS.